You got one of those for me, Reverend? Our Christmas gospel is from the Gospel of Luke, the second chapter, beginning to read at the first verse and reading through to the 20th verse. Luke gives us a schematic of what society was like 2,000 years ago. He begins with Augustus Caesar, who was once called Octavian, the nephew of Julius Caesar, who seizes power in a way which is iron-fisted, to say the least. He is a dictator and a ruler. He builds a huge mausoleum for himself. There are temples in Rome dedicated in his honor. And in 14 AD, when he dies at the age of 75, he is divinized. He is made a god by the Roman Senate. He was a cruel emperor in many ways. And so Luke starts with him and then goes to Quirinius, who is a governor and a puppet of Augustus Caesar. And so we have, in many ways, the top echelon of society. And Luke then, in his gospel, begins to work his way down to Galilean peasants in a far-flung province of Rome, which no Roman ever wanted to live in. And the Galilean peasant was named Joseph and Mary. And then Luke goes a step further and he begins to explore the bottom rung of society in Palestine. And those were shepherds. If you were a shepherd 2,000 years ago, you couldn't serve on a jury because it was thought that your testimony was suspect. If you were a shepherd, you were ipso facto someone who stole things, mostly pasturage, from other people. If you were a shepherd, you didn't make much money. You never went to Harvard. You didn't even go to Dutchess County Community College, which some others could afford back then, maybe. You were poor and poor, and no one would associate with a shepherd. So what we have then is this hierarchical understanding of reality and society, which in the manger is turned upside down. That is the gospel this evening. In those days, Caesar Augustus issued a decree that a census, read a census for taxation. A census should be taken of the entire Roman Empire. This was the first census that took place while Quirinius was governor of Syria. And everyone went to his own town to register. So Joseph also went up from the town of Nazareth in Galilee to Judea, to Bethlehem, the town of David, because he belonged to the house and line of David. He went there to register with Mary, who was pledged to be married to him and was expecting a child. While they were there, the time came for the baby to be born, and she gave birth to her firstborn, a son. She wrapped him in cloths and placed him in a manger because there was no room for them in the inn. And there were shepherds living out in the fields nearby, keeping watch over their flocks at night, and an angel of the Lord appeared to them. And the glory of the Lord shone around them, and they were terrified. But the angel said to them, "Do not be afraid. I bring you good joys and great news that will be for all the people. Today in the town of David, a Savior has been born to you. He is Christ the Lord. This will be a sign to you. You will find a baby wrapped in cloths and lying in a manger. Suddenly, a great company of the heavenly host appeared with the angel, praising God and saying, "Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace to men and women on whom God's favor rests." When the angels had left them and gone into heaven, the shepherds said to one another, "Let's go to Bethlehem and see this thing that has happened, which the Lord has told us about." So they hurried off and found Mary and Joseph and that baby who was lying in the manger. When they had seen him, they spread the word concerning what had been told them about this child, and all who heard it were amazed at what the shepherds said to them. But Mary treasured up all these things and pondered them in her heart. The shepherds returned, glorifying and praising God for all the things they had heard and seen, which were just as they had been told. This is the word of the Lord. In those days, before the birth of Jesus, in those days, there was an unfocused sense of reality. In those days, people picked and chose from a variety of religions that kind of swarmed, which pullulated into Rome itself and into Italy. There were religions from Asia Minor and religions from North Africa and Isis and Serapis coming up from Alexandria. There were all sorts of religions because people didn't know what to focus on. I've been to Turkey 2 times, this year and last year. And both times I go to ancient cities which are often off the tourist track. And I like to go to those stone sarcophagi, often of men and women who were founders and foundresses of the city itself. And there in these stone coffins you see the face of fate. Because no one was sure really where they were going or if they were going anywhere after death. There was an unfocused non-specificity when we looked out at that world. It was a dangerous place until it was transformed by a baby squall. So this evening I want to talk about the focus that Jesus Christ gives us. And how on this evening and also into the new year, we need to focus. That may be the most important word beside the word of faith that you can take with you. And I hope it percolates your nature, because if you know how to focus in a Christ-like manner, the world is yours. And when I look at Joseph and Mary, you know, I see that their focus was on delivering that baby safe and sound. And goodness knows they could have been focused on other things. They started in Nazareth as a peasant couple, and they wended their way 90 miles down to Bethlehem. I've been to the West Bank 3 times. In the 80s, you know, it was a frightening place as it is now. But in Jesus' day, in his parents' day, it was all so frightening as you looked up at the great mountains of Abel and Gerizim and you understand how they cast great and long shadows. Perfect lurking places for robbers. And robbery and pillaging was endemic at that time as they wended their way down and they got down there safely. But how difficult must that have been for a woman pregnant with a child? Have you ever been to the airport and a pregnant woman is in front of you and they ask her to go through the line, you know, so she has to bend down and take off her shoes? Not an easy task, is it? Can you imagine a woman who is very pregnant, perhaps riding on a donkey, going 90 miles south to where she needs to be? Oh, I can see anyone complaining about that. I can see anyone lifting his or her voice to the stars and saying, this just isn't fair. And then they get to Bethlehem and there is no room in the inn. The innkeeper looks at Mary, and perhaps, again, she's heavy with child, and for whatever reason, they're denied passage. Has that ever happened to you? Bruce Larson is a minister up in Seattle, and he had a conference in Atlanta. He's an author as well. And they booked passage to a nice inn outside of Atlanta, and when they got there, their registration had been misplaced so that they didn't have a room. And the concierge was rather direct and said, "I'm sorry, you can't stay here." And Bruce was, and his wife, they were humiliated. Until a friend who was a CEO of a company came by and he said, "They're friends of mine." And then the CEO said to Reverend Larson and his wife, "There's always room if you belong to the right company." You're laughing, right? You've been there. You've been in that position where you're not the right company. And there may not be room for you wherever it is you want to be. And for them, they were not the right company, and so they were denied passage to a place which could have provided them, I think, some privacy and perhaps more cleanliness than they got in the stable. Yeah, that's how they felt too. And so they booked passage and were trundled to a stable. Jerome, who was an early theologian writing in the 5th century, and he was writing from Bethlehem, so he knew some traditions about the stable where Jesus was born, and it may have been a cave. Jerome could say it was a dung heap. The stable that Mary and Joseph occupied was a dung heap. Certainly not fit for the King of the Jews or the King of the world. Simply a dung heap. And what about those shepherds? Those poor shepherds. They could have also, like Joseph and Mary, been very bitter about their lives. They could have said, life offers and affords us nothing. And we're going to rail against the society that ignores us. We're going to rail against the society that pays us poorly. We're going to rail against the society that discriminates against us. But they didn't say that. They simply moved toward Bethlehem and they experienced joy. So, what do you focus on? Are you focusing on negativity? Because there's a lot of it out there, and you can be justified in doing that, can't you? 2012 has been a very, very tough year for many people. It's been a tough year in our society. It's been a tough year in our world. I'm not going to sugarcoat that. And it's been a tough year in our church. We have been convulsed by death. We have been convulsed by other things which have hurt the body of believers. 2012 is tough, and we're looking forward to a better 2013. And yet, when we look at our passage this evening, we are called not to focus on the negativity, but to focus on what is right with our lives. Because as the gospel writer of John says, the darkness has not overcome the light, but the light is in process in our individual lives, getting ready to overcome the darkness. And so in spite of what you've dealt with, Jesus Christ calls you to focus on what is best and good in your life. The Apostle Paul says, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely and gracious, if there is any excellence, if there is anything worthy of praise, you focus on those things. If there is anything of excellence and anything worthy of praise in your life, and there is, because you are the sons and daughters of God, you focus on those things. It's not that we ignore the negativity, but we can deal with negativity only when we have a confident spirit to go out and change and conquer the world. Oh, that gives us strength. There's a story by E.M. Forster called The Captain. The captain wakes up one morning and his wife looks at him and says, "Get out of here. I don't want to see your face today. I'm tired of looking at you. I'm tired of spending time with you. Just go." So the captain puts on his pants and shirts and he leaves. He wanders around the village a little bit and he decides to go and see his best friend, and it's a spring day. The window of his best friend's home is open. And he overhears his best friend's wife saying, "Oh, there comes the captain. Oh, here he comes. I think he's coming to greet us. I think he probably wants to come in and have a spot of tea with us." And so the husband says, "Well, let's hide. Let's pretend we're not at home." The captain goes up and knocks on the door and no one answers. Knocks on it again and no one answers. And he hears the wife saying, "Shh, we have to be even quieter." So the captain leaves. He goes to his favorite pub. And the bartender says to him, "Make it quick. Drink and then get out of here. All right?" And when he sits at the bar stool, everyone else kind of clears a path for him, so that he sits and drinks alone. And then he leaves, and he wanders around. And some of the school children home from school taunt him and make jokes about him. Finally, he gets to a park bench overlooking the sea, and as the sun is going down, he said, "What a great day it is. What a great life it is. I hope I live to be 100. Well, where does that strength come from? It comes from a focus on what is good in our lives and what is good in the world, and somehow ignoring the other things. That's what we need to do if we are to go into 2013 like a freight train with hope and optimism. The second thing I'd like to say is that we need to focus downward on small blessings. Especially if you've been through a tough year this year. If you've been through a tough year this year, you know, I don't want to talk about suffering as being any sort of blessing whatsoever. But I know when people come out of that state of suffering, which we all do, we're not looking at the big ticket items to give us joy and satisfaction. We really are not. Someone, I guess, could wrap a BMW in a pink bow and give it to us. And you know, that might help a little bit, I guess. But when we have suffered and when life has tried us, what happens is that we grow very sensitive to the simple and quotidian and daily joys of living. And that's what life is all about. That's what life is all about. It's about seeing very carefully mangers in our midst. It's about seeing very carefully little babies who are squalling. It is about seeing very carefully that the smallest things can give us life and satisfaction. That we need far less than our consumer culture tells us we need. We need far less. And often it is the small thing that we carry with us throughout our lives. Sometimes it's a symbol, a small gift which represents someone's love for us that takes us through from the beginning of our lives to the end. William Osler was one of the great physicians in England in the 19th century. And he, around Christmas, would visit a number of orphanages that were attached to hospitals. And one orphanage, he became aware of a little girl who seemed to be set apart from the others. And he observed the other children playing and they did not include her. So what he did is he went over to her and he said, "You know, I know you're a special little girl. And I know that God has a special place in his heart for you. And I'm going to tell you a secret, that God loves you. And don't tell anyone else." Well, that secret got the curiosity of those other children, and they kind of migrated over to her, and they said, "What is the secret? What is the secret?" And she said, "I can't tell you. I can't tell you." On Christmas Day, a week later, Dr. Osler came to the orphanage again, and he brought her a little doll. And it was the first Christmas present she ever received. She had never received a Christmas present before. It was the first one. And she took that doll and she nursed it, and it cleaved close to who she was. When that little girl became an old woman, A visitor said, "What's the most precious thing you have?" And she pulled out a drawer and she lifted up a doll that was kind of threadbare and worn. The face was worn, the visage was worn. You could barely see that it was a little girl doll. And she said, "This is my most precious possession. It's small. I don't think it cost much, but it represented someone's love for me at a very dark time in my life. And that's all I needed to get going. That's all I needed to do something amazing with my life. That's all I needed to fly like the wings of an eagle. That's all I needed. Not something big, but something small given in love. Not something big, but something small like a baby in a manger given in love for our salvation, so that from birth to death we know we are more than conquerors, as Paul says in Romans 8, for the one who loves us." And finally, we're called to focus away from negativity. We're called to focus downward toward the small blessings. And finally, we are called to focus on the other. I wonder what Mary and Joseph said to one another after the baby was born and lifted up, the umbilical cord was cut, and little Jesus rested on Mary's deflated stomach. Little Jesus rested on Mary's deflated stomach. I just wonder what Mary and Joseph said to each other. But I'm sure it wasn't, "Merry Christmas, how are you doing?" I'm sure it was, "I love you beyond your imagining." I'm sure it was, "We're in this together and I will never leave you." I'm sure it was, "We've been through a tough time, 90 mile stretch of road, which was like a whole lifetime journey of pain. We've been through discrimination. We've been on top of a dung heap, literally. And yet here we are. And I will cover you, and I will love you, and I will be patient with you until the end of time." I hope this evening, or tomorrow, you take someone you love aside and tell them how you feel. I hope this evening or tomorrow you hold someone's hand that you love and you say to them, "I really love you beyond your imagining." And when they faint, because they haven't heard it from you for quite a while, you revive them and say, "I really, really mean it." Because that's what Christmas is about, I think. And you know what we do to ourselves? Oh, I see it. We do it all the time. Well, I know what we do to ourselves. We get busy with Christmas. We get busy giving gifts and sending gifts and giving cards and, you know, a big dinner and everything. And we get busy because that's easier than getting intimate emotionally or mentally with someone else. You know, it's better to say, "Here's a present, Merry Christmas," than to pull that person aside and say, "You're the present in my life. And my life is rich beyond imagining because you're in it." That takes courage to say it. That takes courage to say it. Better be about, you know, getting busy with Christmas. Better be about getting a lot of presents for people and shoving it in their face so that we don't have to hold a hand or hug or say the words that need to be said. When I was in my late 30s, I've been to Israel 3 times, and the first time I went, I attached a week down in Egypt. And so I was on a train going from Cairo down to Luxor and Karnak in the Valley of the Kings, which was one great experience. And a great experience for me was to wake up in the morning, and as I'm going down the train, you know, to look out to my right, and there's the Nile. And after the Nile, there's this kind of green stretch on both sides of the Nile, paralleling it as we went south. And then all of the gray of the wilderness there. I was with a minister, and he was in flight from a romantic relationship. I said, "Why are you in Egypt?" He said, "I'm here to get away from my girlfriend." I said, "You could have done it in an easier and less expensive way." But he said, no, I'm here to figure out. He said, "I love this woman and this woman loves me, but it's really a May to December romance." He was in his late 30s at the time and she was in her early 20s. And for her it wasn't an issue, but for him it was. And he said the kicker for him was when he said to his almost affianced, "You know, I fought in the Vietnamese War. That's how old I am." And she said, "Oh, that doesn't matter. I know everything about the Vietnamese War. I read about it in high school history. Yeah, I know everything." And he said, "Ancient history, right? Oh, yes, ancient history. I know everything. Don't let that be a problem." But it was for him. So when we got back to Cairo, he said, "I have to go up to Lucerne, Switzerland, and decide." And he had an engagement ring, and he wasn't sure whether he was going to give it. Because he was a minister, he did a lot of praying, and we did a lot of praying. And then I waved goodbye as he got on the plane, and he went to Geneva, I think, and then over to Zurich. And he booked a hotel. His girlfriend was staying with a woman that they had gone to Lazen school. There's a school there for a training school, whatever. And so she was staying with her girlfriend. And he had told her that he was going to be up and make that decision. So he booked this room in a hotel. And it was very, very quiet. And he thought, this is the perfect place in silence to tell her how I feel, to tell her how much I love her. And that's what I need to do. So he said, "I just need to tell you something, dear." And she didn't know what he was going to say. So they go up to the room, and suddenly the room that was so quiet, it was on the second floor. It was the floors were vibrating because there was a band downstairs, and everybody was celebrating whatever. There was more noise and ruckus, and my friend said, "Oh, this is not a good idea." But he said, "Okay." So he knelt down on one knee, he took her hand, and as he said, "Will you," there was a banging on that door, and the latch came undone, the door flew over, and two partiers, who were more than inebriated, kind of fell into the room. He didn't miss a beat. He stayed right where he was, on his knees, with his affianced hand in his hand. And they looked at, you know, they said, "Why, you're in German, why are you in this room? This is our room." My friend didn't say a thing. He just glared at them. And then they looked at the key and realized that the room they had broken into and fallen into was not their room. But they didn't leave. Because in spite of what was going on beneath them, there was a special silence there. The silence that comes when you're focusing on someone you love. And after a few hiccups, the party couple just sat on the bed and observed the engagement proposal. You know, silence can be a wonderful thing. You know, if we focus on another with grace and love, the way God focuses on us, we can change lives and move the world. May you understand that. May you believe that. May you live with hope and possibility on this evening. And may you grasp the hand of someone you love. And don't be ashamed. And don't be embarrassed. To say, just like the young couple in that manger said to each other, "You are my special gift." Thanks be to God. Amen. Let us stand and sing two carols, number 190 and 167.